Hey, it's Emily, your favorite Pod Rocket producer. Did you know that Log Rocket has a TikTok now? You can catch up on all the interview clips from this show, watch UX tutorials, and get more great content from Log Rocket. You can check out the Log Rocket TikTok today at log.rocket. See you on TikTok.
Hi, and welcome to Pod Rocket, a web development podcast brought to you by Log Rocket. Log Rocket provides AI-first session replay and analytics, which surface the UX and technical issues impacting user experiences. Start understanding where your users are struggling by trying it for free at logrocket.com. Hello, everyone. I am your host today, Paige Niedringhaus, and we have Chris Coyer, the co-founder of CodePen, joining us to discuss relatively new things you should know about HTML heading into 2025. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hey, thank you. You have a very good podcast voice, Paige. This is expert.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Oh, this was just a blog post I put together for the Frontend Masters blog, where I like to guest post a little bit these days. Yeah, I wrote it.
It's great to have it because HTML is one of those things that we just don't discuss nearly as much as CSS or JavaScript. So that's a great way to actually get started on why you wrote this post. Why do you think that HTML seems to evolve more slowly than, say, JavaScript or CSS?
Yeah, good question. And I think you're right. It gets a little bit less focus, at least intentional focus by itself, as I feel like sometimes you talk about CSS and CSS doesn't do anything by itself. It like has to be connected to HTML to do anything. You end up talking about both plenty. But as far as I tried to keep the post to be like, these are things that are like definitely directly right in HTML and they may interact with other technologies, but they have an element of changed HTML that is relevant to them. Does it move slower? It does. And I wonder what the combination of factors is that make it that way. Without answering the question directly, I think it's good that it does move relatively slowly. I was thinking about this concept invented very much not by me, and I forget all the people to properly credit for it, but there's a concept called pace layers, and it can be applied to all kinds of different things, scientifically and whatnot. Think of it as the crusts of the Earth or the layers of a planet. There's the core, and that stuff moves really slowly. And then as the rings go outside, the outside rings move a bit faster. If you're going to map that onto front-end technology, certainly some of the outside rings would be stuff like JavaScript, but not just JavaScript, like the frameworks on top of JavaScript. There's like a joke that people have like days since last JavaScript framework, and it's always at zero. That stuff is constantly moving really quickly. But maybe the language of JavaScript is a layer deeper than it. Like it moves decently quickly as well. In fact, they have a specified cadence of yearly releases of the ECMAScript stuff. And then maybe CSS is starting to be at that same level. Traditionally, it's moved a bit slower than JavaScript. The last year or two, you could probably make the case that it's moving just as fast, really. HTML is certainly lower level than that. There's no yearly releases. There's never really been a named release except for back in HTML5, which now feels like ancient history. I'm sure there's people working in the industry that don't really remember that or were a part of that, probably. And even that wasn't like absolutely littered with HTML changes. Even that, in a sense, was almost more about the CSS features we got at the time than HTML ones. Yeah, so it just moves a little slower, but because it's so foundational, every single website in the entire world uses HTML. It's not optional. That's there. Even like old school Flash sites, the Flash was booted up from an HTML template. I think you have to be intentionally careful about those lower layers in the pace. It may not be able to be moved that quickly. There's standards bodies involved in a lot more websites. The people that are responsible for not breaking websites tend to do a pretty good job with that. And I suspect that they're very extra super careful with HTML because that could have pretty huge implications.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as I was reading through your article, is that you mentioned in a few instances the backwards compatibility is so key to not breaking the rest of the internet that existed before these new pseudo elements got added or new attributes or things like that. So I think you're absolutely right. It's just there's already been so much built on top of HTML that it just cannot move that quickly for fear of busting a quarter of the internet with a quick change.
Truly. One interesting counterpoint to it, or related point, is that it is a lot more forgiving than other languages. Like, for example, JavaScript can throw. If you have a problem in a line of JavaScript, it can throw an error and it will stop the execution of that file entirely. Whereas there is no throwing in HTML. The browser's just going to crank through that thing and try to figure out the best thing to do. Now, it might have to make some pretty weird choices. Perhaps you've seen, if you have unclosed tags that are required to be closed, the DOM that gets produced from that can be awfully weird and unpredictable. Yeah, it's weird. But isn't that cool, though, that it really tries its hardest to blast through that HTML and figure out what to do despite there being problems in it? That gives it some pretty interesting resiliency, I think. And that, let's say we invented a new tag, and one of the things on the list here, I think, was the search tag that is relatively new. Very rarely do we just get brand new tags in HTML. I wonder if that speed will change. Something about them is like they're a little boring. You know, they're like, they tend to be just automatically apply an ARIA role if we get one that's useful in a way. Yeah, I don't know. The article tag as an implied ARIA role of, I forget, maybe it's just article. I forget what it is. But that's the whole point of this new search tag. It's literally angle bracket search, close angle bracket. It's a new tag. And it automatically has the ARIA or role equals search. It is an ARIA role, I think, but you don't write ARIA role. That confuses me sometimes. You just write role. And that is a search role. Is it a big deal? No, because you could put div role equals search on whatever. It's still a good idea. I'm glad it rolled out. I'm glad we have it now, just because there's some intuition behind it. It's, I don't know, maybe you'll remember now. I think that was my point, is that like, you probably should have that role around it. Probably tons of people forget it. I would say the vast majority of websites have no role equals search anywhere on them. So we have an HTML tag and it's called search. Now it just feels good to just wrap that search area in a search tag. Hey, why not? I love it. So that's cool. What will happen in a browser that has no idea what the search tag is? Not much. It won't have that role on it. That could be a problem. So you might consider putting the role on it anyway, which feels a little counterintuitive. You may consider that for older browser support. Maybe remove it someday with a twinkle in his eye or whatever. But it won't be a big, huge problem, because of the resiliency of HTML. It's not going to throw when it sees that search tag. It's just going to truck right on through and be like, that's fine. I guess it's a span. It essentially treats it like an unknown inline element. So fine. Unknown attribute, fine. It just throws it away. That type of thing is built into the language, which is cool.
Talking about some of those new elements, there are some new pseudo element features that have come out that are pretty cool. So could you talk about some of the new cases for the details content pseudo element in particular?
Yeah, good language there. It is a pseudo element because it has the double dots. That's, I don't know if everybody has that locked in their head, but the single colon in CSS, when it's used as part of a selector, is a pseudo class, which often means it's part of the state of something, whereas a pseudo element is, I don't know, it's like you're selecting an element, but that element doesn't exist in the HTML. So pseudo element is the perfect name for it. That particular one is relatively new. If you can picture the details element in HTML, it's just angle bracket, details, angle bracket, and then you put some stuff inside it and close it. You will automatically get a toggle for that. Okay. And now if you want to control what it says in that toggle, then you put a summary element there and you can say, I don't know, spoiler or the FAQ question you're trying to make a toggle for or something. You don't have to use summary, but you can. Aside from the summary, you can put whatever in there. There could be 10 paragraphs in there. There could be a figure. There could be literally any HTML could be within that details, and it will all get collapsed up when it's closed. So there's an unknown amount of content in there. And before, there really was no good selector to say, give me everything inside the details except for the summary. So that's all the details content is, just one quick little way to grab all the stuff in there, unknown stuff, except for the summary. And it's just a convenience thing. It's just a little bit nice to have. I don't know the exact details of why they decided to put that out there or whatever, but I suspect that a little bit of it was part of that. There was a lot of call for, I would like to be able to animate the opening and closing of details elements. People want that. And I think that it helps a little bit with that, that you can, I don't know, fade out the height of it, all of them combined or whatever, and get that going a little easier.
Nice. All right. So there's a new CSS approach of appearance-based select. Could you talk about what exactly this is and how it differs from some of the earlier like select menu element concepts?
Yeah, I get, you know, appearance is a CSS property. So we've already deviated from our HTML talk a little bit, but it's so directly related to HTML because what it applies to, and it can only apply to in this case, a select menu, meaning angle bracket, select, close angle bracket, which are the ones that have a special UI. You open it up and it gives you a bunch of options and whatever, and you select one of them. And I suppose people know on mobile too, that the mobile experience for those is who knows what. Like on iOS, you get a little spinnery thing, and I don't know, it changes. And that's good that the spec isn't super specific about that. It's implementers are free to put in good UI for it however they want to. Now, that select menu is used on an absolute crap load of websites. Select is just a very useful element. Select one of these options, great. But famously isn't particularly easy to style. And when I mean style, I mean mostly the inside of it, like that opened up state of it, that is hard to style. The outside of it was hard to style too at one point, but that's changed. You can pretty much style the outside of a select menu however you need to these days. But then you open it up and it looks just like your operating system select menus do. Like you have so little control over that. And so CSS wanted to change that. It turns out, and you mentioned the select menu element too, that was just like an early experiment or something. We thought maybe that's what it would be. Like, let's have a new element, but this one you'll be able to style the inside of it, but it will otherwise behave the same. And it turns out that worked, and we can do that. It's just that having this new HTML element was like, how do you start opting into using that? It's really messy. Hence why HTML has to move slowly. You can't just do that to us. It would have to be some kind of JavaScript detection if that element worked properly, and then you'd have to swap it out, the entire HTML element. And having a progressive enhancement that is only JavaScript focused is a little unfair or doesn't work as well as you want. So they decided, okay, let's skip, kill it. And I wasn't like part of these conversations or anything, but let's not have select menu. Let's keep the one we've already got, select, which is much more progressive enhancement friendly thing. But we want to unlock the ability to style anything you want inside of it, because apparently that works. But how do we do that? We can't. One way we could do it is just roll it out. Now, hey, surprise, you can now style everything you want to inside of it. The only reason you can't do that, and they didn't go that way, this I do know, is that it will break the web, because there's probably lots of CSS out there in the world that's trying to style the inside of it and failing to do because you can't, that will all of a sudden start applying to those select elements. And who knows? Maybe somebody like tried 5 things and they didn't work and they just left them in the CSS. So it's this half-styled disaster. And all of a sudden that would start applying to the select element. That's like unacceptable. And if it was 2 websites that did that, I'm sure they would probably consider doing it. But they have metrics on this stuff. That type of stuff can be looked at, because some of this research happens by, for example, Google, who has lots of information about this, can scour the web and figure out, oh, there's 10,522 major websites that have this problem. So we're not going to do that. All that to be said, you need an opt-in. You need some way to say, I want my select to behave like that, but I, author, am saying it's okay. That's what opt-ins are, and this is what it is. For this particular element, the select element, if you want that behavior, you have to say appearance colon base dash select. The appearance property is super weird. It's still weird. It's going to be weird forever properly, but that's the opt-in. So there's a little bit more to it.
I honestly didn't know that it existed before reading that.
You look at the other values of it. It almost appears like you could, for example, make a span turn into a radio button or something. It implies that's what it could possibly do, but I actually don't even really remember. I think there's a couple of times it would show up in my style sheets as far, like a reset, Like it would be used in that way to knock a style away, not add a style. But that's cool to see this opt-in idea keep going. That I haven't seen a lot of that historically in HTML and CSS, like opt-ins for different behavior. So I think this is cracking a nut a little bit, and it could be good. There's a famous document of like mistakes in CSS that is done by the spec people themselves. It's almost like a hey, sorry about that document, like weird values and stuff. One kind of famous one is, have you ever seen that star selector that sets box sizing border box on everything? Yeah, they say that's in the document. They're like, yeah, we should have had that just be the default because it's just better, more logical behavior. But wouldn't that be neat if you could opt in? I don't think this is going to happen. This is just wishful thinking. But that you could put something in your CSS that opted into a whole slew of new behavior like that. Like you don't want to set box sizing border box on everything, that you could just opt into like CSS 5 or whatever. So maybe we'll see that, but we'll, I think this opt-in idea is more. Have you seen CSS has these page transitions now where like without implementing single page app or anything, you can have an element, for example, move across the screen, even though all you did was click an anchor link. Yeah. You have to opt into that behavior.
That's actually what I was thinking about as we were talking about opt-in for HTML, is that CSS in recent years has gotten pretty good at progressive applications where if the browser supports it, it'll do the cool animation or it'll have the great transition or whatever. And if it doesn't, it's still got everything that needs to be there is still there. It just maybe isn't as slick or as polished as some of the new features that the newer browsers support. And that seems like what HTML is trying to do. They're like, if you have it already and it's old, it's fine. But if you want to do something new with it, style it, make it different, here's the way to do that.
Right. That is just a good way to work. I think it would be really hard to argue. Also, sometimes the author of the website needs to think like that and code like that for that to happen. And sometimes it's so baked into how the feature works that you don't really need it. That's just how it works. I think of these, like CSS has these scroll-driven animations, and it tends to be the kind of feature that's never going to be ultra crucial to a website. So if they totally outright fail on a website, like you were saying, it just doesn't matter. It just works. Scrolling works how it always worked. Now, I'm not guaranteeing that. Maybe you've coded some div that slides in when you scroll down, and the default state of that div, you've kicked off the page. And so if it doesn't work, it will never scroll onto the page. That would be a problem. That means that as an author, you do need to be cognizant of failure and not failure conditions. Yeah, but view transitions is a great one. That will almost never, all that is styling a little in-between state, a little animation state. That is a perfect example of almost certainly will not matter if it doesn't work.
Right. All right, let's talk a little bit more about that. So Safari has implemented a checkbox where it's actually an input, but you set the type of checkbox and then you set switch, which is making the toggle that we all love. Practically every application needs at least one. And we've all had to do these super janky HTML monstrosities in the past to make switches work. Or we just install a component library that does it for us.
Yeah.
It's an interesting preview that they're trying to make an actual HTML element that can support that. How do you see this kind of evolving in the future?
Because some of it is great. I think the way that you described it there is super true. These are really common UI elements. They're really common because they're a good idea. They visually show a concept really nicely. Imagine, like, do I want to get this email notification or not in the settings area of an app? And you slide it on or off. That's probably a little more clear if it has an on and an off label, and you can see the toggle on the off side. That's even more clear than an unchecked checkbox. Like, it's just good design. This one comes from Apple, and the good and bad of it, I don't know the whole story, but I've heard a little whispers of, yeah, that's nice and all, but it really just came out of nowhere a little bit. I think there is maybe some specs or something, but it felt just a little bit like, and this is, I think people get salty about this because even though Chrome's probably even more guilty these days and just like steamrolling features sometimes, this was Apple steamrolling a feature. It's just like, yeah, we're going to do this. Here you go. It's now in Safari. And that matters when it comes to unprefixed, unflagged stuff. Mm-hmm. Because if they roll this out and that's just the way it's going to be on the web, but it doesn't work in any other browser, it puts authors of websites in a really strange position. Am I going to do this then? How do I code around it? If it's a problem, I don't know. And if it happens once on one thing, we're kind of like, okay, that's a little annoying. Company's going to fight or whatever. But if it starts happening more and we stop as web developers yelling at these companies about that, don't do that, then they're going to do it more and more. And all of a sudden, Chrome's got 10 features that no other browser has, and Firefox has their own crap, and Safari has their own crap, and it makes authoring of websites, it starts to get totally untenable. That was the feeling back in like the browser wars day, is that creating websites sucks more. It makes our jobs worse. But worse than that, we just won't do it. Most people just won't. And then that makes the web suck, and then it makes the web start to lose. And that's dangerous too, because it's this beautiful open sharing platform thing that no one company has a bunch of control over. I think people are feeling that right now, is that you're like, do you want a web that's like fully controlled by like Mark Zuckerberg or whatever? Is that what you want? Do you want one person at the top deciding all these features, or do you want the good and bad and chaos and beauty of the web? It's the latter. You want the latter.
That's the whole reason that the Interop project was started, was that so all the browsers would support all sorts of different things in a similar fashion. So you didn't have to worry that Firefox didn't have Flexbox support or that Safari's accessibility was behind. That's the whole reason for these working groups to be together and pick things that they're going to focus right on every year.
And it's worth celebrating because mostly it works great. Just got to watch it. Yeah, yeah, I think it's mostly a big success, really. Yeah, Interop's a great example too. They pick a few things and they make sure that they work really well across, and everybody's on board. It feels like a period of peace and prosperity for the web in that way. And I'd like to see that continue.
All right. So do you think that developers are, how is the declarative shadow DOM going to actually reshape the landscape? Because I know it's a big thing for web component-based frameworks, and there's the whole SSR versus client-side debate. And now declarative shadow DOM is here, and it says that it can do the server-side rendering that web components were never able to do before. So do you think that this is really going to have a big impact on web component stuff in general?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Because the story of web components is also 4 books long, maybe. And it's tempting to say kind of a slow pickup in adoption as well as like user satisfaction and stuff. I say slow a little bit. It's not that if you haven't used them, don't interpret my saying slow as nobody's using them. It's a joke, because there is a lot of use out there, actually. It's pretty decent. I think user satisfaction and their capabilities and stuff is really growing, and it's probably higher than you think it is. So cool. If anybody has no idea what I'm talking about, a web component is a pretty specific thing in the web. And one way to think about it is that you just get to invent your own HTML tags, essentially. So imagine you have a whole design system. One way you could approach that is through web components, and you could call it LogRocket button, LogRocket card, LogRocket video element, whatever. Or you could say LG. Great. And they have to have a dash in them, little quirk. And these are called custom elements. And you create them and you just sprinkle them throughout your HTML. And then you get to decide how they look, how they behave, what the content is inside them. It's a pretty powerful concept. I'd liken it a little bit to a React component or a Vue component or Angular component or whatever. But there are some pretty important differences there. Web components are a little bit more base level. And they don't really provide a lot of the same stuff that you're used to. Like, why would you use a React component? You get a bunch of stuff. You get all these hooks, for example, for managing state within that React component. A web component doesn't give you that. You can figure that out. You can add that in. But the base technology that we get right from browsers doesn't really have anything specifically for state management, for example. And it's not that it's weaker, but they have their own tricks up their sleeve. One of those tricks up their sleeve is the Shadow DOM. It's this protected, it's almost like an iframe-like protection between the outside page and the inside page. It's not that strong, but it's pretty strong. Not a lot of less styles seeping in and out of the CSS that gets applied there. Depending on the settings, may not be able to query selector all through that Shadow DOM boundary and stuff. It's a level of protection that can be pretty desirable on the web. Not always. I certainly have mixed feelings on it myself, but some people specifically use and like web components because of the Shadow DOM. That's necessary and that's what they roll with. But if before what you called or named correctly declarative Shadow DOM, the only way you could have Shadow DOM at all was if JavaScript instantiated it. And that's just a little unlike the web normally. Usually JavaScript is interactive functionality, at least if you want to, can be sprinkled on top of HTML content. It was a little weird that in order to take advantage of Shadow DOM at all, it had to be written into the DOM through JavaScript. And declarative Shadow DOM is that step in the other direction. It says, oh, no, you can have Shadow DOM, just do it like this. There's a special syntax for it, and then it will get instantiated into that component before JavaScript renders at all. JavaScript can still execute and can still do stuff in there later, but it's like, if you're thinking of, I don't know, people that are performance-minded or just generally work on the web, the web way that websites boot up is the first thing that arrives at the browser is the HTML. It gets parsed really quickly, even pre-parsed, and the browser engine is starting to reach out and grab images and CSS and other resources that it needs, and then it parses those and finds more resources, and it has a lot of work to do, but the first thing that comes down is that HTML. And the fact that now you can design these web components, even taking advantage of Shadow DOM, and have probably, hopefully, most of what it needs already there in the HTML, so it can make that first rendering pass before JavaScript, which tends to load later and be a little slower and be a little more fragile. It's already there. So it unlocks that idea, which is pretty good. Now, how big of a deal really is that? I don't know. One of the problems I see with it is that typically if you have, like if LogRocket was going to build the homepage for this podcast or whatever and have a podcast card component, each one of those cards, and maybe there's 10 of them on the website, it's going to have different stuff in it. The title's going to be different, the URLs are different, the content, the hero image, all that stuff. Now you could put all that stuff into the declarative Shadow DOM or whatever, but it doesn't, you have to hand author it, right? Like you're just writing that out, and it feels like the technology begs to not hand it. Feels like a React component, you're mapping over a loop and you're just giving it some data and it's producing that stuff. It feels more like a lower level technology that a framework on top of it is designed to produce that declarative Shadow DOM HTML for you. And we just haven't seen a lot of that yet because it's new enough and there's enough friction between the JavaScript frameworks and meta frameworks that be today, like Next and Nuxt and all these things. They have their own component models that they don't really need web components or Shadow DOM. So they're in the business of, I guess we'll support the bare minimum of this if we have to, but there is no Next.js of web components. There's nobody that's, I'm just going to use the not React and try to do the technologies. I would guess that's coming because the advantage is to just doing web the native way. But I don't know. I guess we haven't seen it yet, or I haven't seen it.
Yeah. React has been incredibly slow to embrace web components at all. It took until React 19 just recently to say that they actually do support them. So yeah, it'll be interesting if anybody feels like this is a new way that they want to build websites, if they've already been using Svelte or React or Vue or what have you. And there are very simple ways to just duplicate components with all sorts of different information in them instead of having to hand write it like you would for an older style website.
We should be careful not to make at odds something like React and web components. They don't have to be enemies. It doesn't have to be either or. It can be different than that. For example, a design system is a great use case for web components. You could make 100 of them, and that's what your company uses to build websites with. And then you could consume those web components in React. That's perfectly fine and a good way of doing it. In fact, a smart way of doing it, because later on, if some new CTO joins and says, we should use this new framework, your web components are going to come along just fine on that journey, whereas your components will not. So there's some advantages to doing that. And it makes them not enemies. It makes them friends, perhaps. There's a project called Web Awesome that's in the midst of being created and has a lot of hype behind it, frankly. A lot of it is just grab and go component. Hey, that table element looks great. I'm just going to use that. And guess where you can use it? Anywhere. You can use it with a JavaScript framework because now across the board, there are supporting web components. You can use it just on an HTML site. You can use it anywhere you want to. They don't have to fight with your framework components. They can live together nicely. Now, wouldn't it be neat, though, if there was a web component framework that was web components native right away? It does use those, but it gives us the stuff that we want. It gives us state management. Crucially, it would give us routing. I think that's a big reason why people use Next.js, is you have this folder full of folders in there that control how the website, what URLs go where, and what components get rendered when they do. It's a big deal. Somebody could write that for web components. They could have a design system dash routing component that you call and it does routing. That's what we haven't seen a lot of that.
Yeah. Some other good ones that I have heard about, I haven't used web components too much in my own development, but Shoelace and Lit, I think, were two other pretty popular web component libraries for people.
For sure. Shoelace is becoming Web Awesome. So that's, you're right on there. I think that team is now works there or something, or yeah, or like Shoelace 2.0 is Web Awesome or something. Yeah, great example. And Lit is great too. I don't know if Web Awesome uses Lit, but it's like it's not like here's the Lit button. It's a framework for building web components on. I'm a pretty big fan. I think it's nice because there's enough like boilerplate crap. Because again, web components are a native vanilla technology. And as weird as this is to me, the powers that be have said, we created these APIs as if a framework author was going to be using them. Like it's almost designed to have a framework on top of it, which I find particularly strange. Yeah. But Lit gives you some nice stuff, like the way that it, you know, like you're going to want click handlers on your stuff, right? They have a nice little like syntax for event handling stuff. And they have a way to declare some variables that you are going to then sprinkle into the template of that component, which is the point of templates a lot of times. And then if you change the value of those declared properties, it can go in with that surgical DOM manipulation stuff to change it. Like it's efficient at updating the DOM. Another reason that was why people picked React early on is they're like, ooh, it's got this magical virtual DOM and it's really efficient at updating the DOM. That's become more like old news. Yeah, it better be. But a web component doesn't know how to update its own DOM efficiently automatically. Usually what you do is just call the render method and then it re-renders the entire thing. Whereas Lit, by virtue of using this tiny little library, has more of that. I'll just update the little tiny piece of DOM that I need to.
Nice. All right, let's move on from web components because I want to talk about the inert option. It's something that I don't think people are very aware of, even as web developers, unless you use modals and things pretty regularly. So maybe you could talk about what are some of the practical scenarios where inert can really help simplify code and make it easier for developers.
Basically wiped off the face of the earth as far as that website is concerned. You can't click it, you can't select it, it's not a part of the accessibility tree, it's just gone, which can be a big deal. You probably should be using it in situations where you want it to be gone. Like if it's some off-page navigation or something that's just not there right now and later comes onto the page to be used, but it's not on the page, just inert. It's one attribute and it just does a lot to make sure that things aren't being like accidentally tabbed to or accidentally selected or blah, 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 blah. So it's nice in that way. I was more excited about it before Dialog came along, and Dialog kind of inherently has this. So what you want when a dialogue is open, specifically a modal dialogue, the word modal meaning like you need to deal with what's going on in this modal before you do anything else. That's, you should know that when you use a modal dialogue, that's the point. Your users can't do anything else. Now, if you're going to home roll this thing with a div, you're not doing that then. if all of a sudden is you just show a div and you style it to be in the middle of the page and stuff, you haven't stopped, for example, somebody from tabbing. First of all, did you move focus into that div? You probably didn't, because nobody does these things right. Then when you close it, did you put their focus back to where they entered it from? Almost certainly you didn't do that one. Then what if inside it and they're tabbing around, they could tab right out of it. And now they're focused on something that you've probably hidden with a black overlay. So they can't even see the thing that they're focused on. Probably screwed that up too, right? There's all these things to screw up. But now if you use dialogue, it's like the whole page has inert on it, except for the dialogue. So as you tab around, you can't tab out of it. It's become the entire page. So that's pretty cool. You don't need to use inert though with dialogue. You just get that behavior for free. So it's like inert is useful in that situation if you want to code that similar experience yourself and you have reason to not use dialogue. At least it's gotten a lot easier because that focus trappy type of stuff had to be replicated in the past and was, I heard it once called the boss mode of accessibility. It's one of the harder criteria of accessibility to get right.
Yes.
So, and now we don't have to because we just use dialogue. Although I would suspect that websites with dialogues on it, what do you think? 5% of websites or something? It's probably pretty low.
It probably honestly is. There are so many libraries that are out there for modals in particular, just because they are such difficult things to make work correctly that right. I would say there's probably still a lot of those doing very well in the NPM downloads.
Yeah, certainly. Because one of the ways that those things get popular is not just that it handles the accessibility correctly. It's probably that because right. It's animated in nicely. It's really beautiful looking.
You can style it however you need to, all those types of things. All right. So what are some new design possibilities that come from being able to do full page navigation with pure HTML and CSS and multi-page view transitions that are unlocked for traditional server rendered sites?
Yeah, that's what we were talking about before. The view transitions, but you have to be careful because it's kind of part of the same spec as these JavaScript triggered view transitions, which are also very cool. But it's a little even more impressive, perhaps, to see cross page view transitions. A lot of times you have a traditional site, you just click an anchor link and you go to some other site. The whole page unloads. You know, in the back in the day, we'd see white while that was happening. You know, that's, I wouldn't say super recently, but I think browsers have like paint holding or something now where it's a little less, you don't see the white anymore and stuff like that. But what's essentially happening is like the browser is temporarily dead. It can do nothing while that new page is loading. And a view transition has the ability to animate in that kind of dead state. So it does it by essentially taking a screenshot or like a live rendering of what was there before, because then it can be unloaded and fine, but you still have that. And then it moves it through magic or whatever into the new location that it needed to be. And part of the beauty of the API is that all it needs to really do that is for those two elements to have the same CSS property and value applied to them. View transition name, and then something that's totally unique as a value to it. And the reason I put it in the HTML one is, one, it's in HTML and it works between anchor links, so it's relevant that way. And that totally unique view transition names are probably more commonly applied at the moment, and there's some talk around this that may change, but more commonly applied in HTML. If we remember thinking of the LogRocket podcast page or whatever, each podcast would have like view transition name podcast one, view transition name podcast two, or podcast some unique identifier from the database or something. And then as you click one of those from having 10 cards to looking at one podcast, for example, that you could have it fly around the page however you want to make that kind of a cool looking transition. So it's just amazing that we can do that. One reason is that that can be so cool that it makes people want to reach for a framework just to do that. And it's cool that it's now you can do it without the framework. I don't know if that's like number one. I like it for lots of reasons, but I think that we haven't mentioned there's this like with the search element or with other things that we've talked about today, there's this like spec concept that I've always liked called paving the cow paths, which is like the metaphor comes from look where the cows walk and then make the path there. Do the work where it's already been proven that there's need. And that happens here. What are developers just doing? What do they really want to do and are forcing it into the web platform because they really want to do it? Like the Switch is a great example, that the toggle switch, let's just make it easy. That view transitions is like that, and the Switch is a great element as well. That's spec people and browser makers paving the cow paths. That's what you want to see.
Developers want to style scroll bars and they want to style checkboxes.
Yeah. So we got one of them pretty much. I know you can style scroll bars a little bit, but they're a little more hesitant to help with
the checkbox. Chris, it has been great to talk to you today. Is there anything that we haven't covered yet that you want listeners to be aware of?
I don't know. I think you're ahead of the game by listening to this podcast and caring about this stuff at all. So well done already. But yeah, keep an eye on it and be mad when you need to, when web browsers do stuff all by themselves. Be like, did that go through the proper spec process? Better have.
If people want to find you online or ask you more questions about some of these new HTML elements, where are the best places to reach you?
I maintain a personal site at my name, which is chriscoyer.net, which tends to link out to the other things that I do. And I'm the co-founder of CodePen, like you said, and I spend most of my day continuing to build it and make it better. And I hang out there.
Thank you again for joining us. It has been great to talk to you today.
My pleasure.